From WHQR Public Radio in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. When you think about disability and how you define it, what comes to mind? A child who doesn't learn through conventional methods? An older person who struggles to get groceries from the car to the front door? Do you imagine a person in a wheelchair? One disability scholar says our binary view of ability, or lack of it, is misguided. Ability spans a spectrum from Olympic-level athleticism to death, and we're all somewhere on that spectrum. Today, we're going to explore how we look at disability and what impact those views have on all of us through the systems we create. Julianne Scott Pollack is an associate professor of communication studies at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. She studies personal narratives of embodiment and identity and looks at physical disability, eating disorders, and aging and memory. Julianne Scott Pollack, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
And we're inviting you to join the conversation. Do you have a question about relating to someone with a disability? Do you have a disability and get tired of hearing rude questions or even the same old jokes? What do you wish people understood? Give us a call on this Wednesday at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. Julianne Scott Pollack, before we get into your areas of study, this area of research for you, looking at body perception, is personal. What sparked your interest to begin with?
Well, what sparked my interest? I always go back in time to some of my first memories. And I was born with cerebral palsy. I have spastic cerebral palsy, which means how I walk is stiffer than how the average person would walk. And part of it is the message that's coming from my brain to my legs produces a reaction that would happen if someone stuck your leg with a pin. How you sort of jump, it's a little bit jerky. So because of that, I don't bend my knees as much. I don't bend my feet as much. It's a stiffer kind of walk. And in the beginning, when I was younger, that also produced my turned over back. I was a little bit hunched. My knees faced each other. My feet faced each other. So I was up on my toes. It was a little bit more jarring to look at. And I remember seeing people see me and having to navigate, it's like that look of confusion, that look of sadness.
How old were you when you first noticed the way people saw you?
It's one of my first memories. I'm about 4, and I'm walking into a store, and it has a window for the door. And I'm walking, and I'm feeling cute, and like this cute little outfit I'm wearing at 4, whatever 4-year-old fashion was. It was pink and white, I remember. And I saw a mother and her daughter looking at me, looking kind of sad. And I was like, why? And then I looked in the mirror and I realized as I was walking what they were seeing. And I saw that my body produced sadness and concern for some people. And so from a very young age, that reality was there. And having to navigate that, because for me, I wasn't sad. Life was good. But realizing that people were frightened or sad for me in so many ways. And so I think it started very early. I think I became expressive early for those same reasons of wanting to put people at ease, wanting people to know that I was okay, they were okay, we could really all get along and be at ease with one another. And I think that's what really led me in this idea of narrative research, of the power of story, of the ability to connect and relate to people, and with ability at the center of that.
And how has your disability changed over the years? You talk about it, you use the word jarring. It looked more jarring when you were younger. How has it changed?
Well, when I was younger, because the muscles had turned my feet in towards each other, and they had also pulled so tight from all this spasming over and over again from these jerky, jerky signals that my feet were perched on my toes, which then hunched my back to kind of balance. So through a series of operations, they lengthened those muscles in my legs. They actually sawed my bones in half, rotated them 30 degrees, and nailed them back together again. And so over time, I went from, wow, something's really wrong with her, like, What happened there? Are she maybe recovering from a car accident? Sometimes people, when they see me from the gym, they're like, oh, you worked out too hard. Be careful. Make sure you heal. I had a trainer come up to me very anxious as I keep seeing you getting back on that elliptical. And until you heal, please don't. He goes, you need to leave. You need to let. I'm like, really, I'm okay. It's going to be fine. Because he immediately saw that this is an able-bodied person who is working out while injured. So it's changed in that way. Now, if you have a trained eye, it's clearly a spastic cerebral palsy walk. I had a retired physician chase me down at church once saying, cerebral palsy, right? And he's like, I said, yes. He goes, I knew it. You know, and I was like, yes, yes. To someone who knows disability, it's very obvious, but other people fit it into their narrative of what they think it might be.
And how do you feel about that? I mean, the guy at the gym, the trainer who is concerned about you, do you take the time to explain? Or do you just say, thanks, I'm fine, and move on?
Well, you know, it depends on how much time I have. I mean, I did say to the trainer, I said, actually, I have spastic cerebral palsy, and this is just how I walk. I'm good. He goes, oh, I'm so sorry. It's like, it definitely was not caused by you. It was congenital. You're not responsible. I'm okay. And thanks for looking out. And he was fine, and we were able to have conversations.
The guy in the church, the doctor in the church, proud of his own diagnosis from afar, is that irritating at all? Or
no,
that make you feel objectified a little bit?
Well, you know, it does in some ways. But I've learned over time, people are asking, which is promoting communication. And I've become a professor of storytelling. I believe in communication. I really think that interactions do shape our reality, that it really meanings, understanding, identity, who we are, who others are, is all formed through that interaction. So if I shut down that interaction, I'm losing chances to recreate how people are thinking, to struggle with them, to develop new understandings. And I enjoy talking to him a little bit about it. And he's like, and he said to me, he goes, have you had operations? Was it just like this? And I said, I have. And, you know, he had stories to tell. He wanted to talk to me about kids he knew that had had cerebral palsy, and he had hoped that the operations had turned out as good as mine had. So he had a reason that he wanted to connect with me that day. And so while I would have maybe liked just to go to my car and get out of the parking lot before we had to wait in line, it was okay to make that connection, because I think he needed that connection to start processing what it meant to have CP.
So are people then who have obvious physical disabilities automatically catapulted into this position of being spokespeople for whatever their particular disability is?
Well, you are, and you shouldn't have to be. And that's something that I think is very important. Rosemary Garland Thompson is a great scholar on staring and the gaze and how we navigate that. And I think it's so important to remember that that person doesn't owe you any explanation if they don't want to. Communication does create interaction, create meaning, create understanding. But it's okay to say, you know what? I'm not up for meaning making right now. I just want to be left alone. And so I think it's okay as a disabled person to say, listen, this is none of your business. And it's okay to give someone a snarky reply that shuts things down. I tend to not do that, but I have a different agenda, maybe, than someone who really their agenda is just to get their groceries and move on without talking to you who's standing behind them in line.
You said as a disabled person.
I did.
And we've been taught to use person first language, a person with a disability. Mm-hmm. Why do you make that choice? Why do you say disabled person?
Well, I say disabled person because I don't want disability to be so uncomfortable, so stigmatizing, so sad that we have to change the rules of how we do the English language to talk about it. In our language, we put adjectives first. And just like I am a brunette woman, and I am a straight woman, and I am an academic woman, a white woman, I'm also a disabled woman. So for me, I want to claim that adjective first, disability first language to because I don't find it as off-putting as perhaps the people who decided we should put it after find it. And so in a lot of ways, it's a small piece of activism for me to try to normalize and be at ease with others and my identity and my body.
You've spent time looking at personal identity around this through what you call personal narrative scholarship. Mm-hmm. What is that? How do you do that? How do you do your conduct your studies?
Well, I do what's called open-ended interviewing. And that means I want who I'm talking to direct what's important, what are the meanings. So I don't want to give too direct of questions because then I'm transferring it to what I think is important and they're answering those questions. So we talk about the topic. I say, I'm interested, like I study people who self-identified as physically disabled professionals. So I say to them, I'm interested in stories about what it means to be a physically disabled professional. And I want you to begin where that story begins and end where that story ends. And then what I do is I record that entire interview, and we interact throughout it. And I will ask some questions to get things going if they need them. I have a reserve of questions to start thinking about if someone just doesn't know where to begin. And then I look for the what's called an emergent theme, which means not a theme that I was expecting, but across these interviews, what is coming up? What are people saying over and over again? And that forms the analysis.
What is the primary emergent theme among disabled professionals?
Well, there was several of them. One thing a lot of physically disabled professionals talked about, this idea of needing to fit into a character of what it means to be a disabled person in the office. Like it's like saying, I feel like I need to be a superhero or I need to be a tragic hero. And by tragic hero, they mean remove yourself from the office because you're disruptive, right? And so that idea of, but then wanting to stay meant they were turning into a villain.
We're going to explore these archetypes a little bit more when we come back from the break. You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. It's a discussion about our cultural ideas and resulting treatment of people with disabilities. Julianne Scott Pollock researches personal narratives and body image perception at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. And she's answering your questions on this Wednesday. What have you always wondered about life with a disability? Now is your chance to ask an expert. The phone lines are open. Call us today at 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org. You're listening to Coastline. Listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Today, we're exploring life with a disability, what disability means, the stigma surrounding it. And here to answer your questions on this Wednesday is disability researcher Julianne Scott Pollock. She is an associate professor in the Communication Studies Department at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. You can reach us now at coastline@whqr.org or call us on this Wednesday at 910-343-1138. The phone lines are open. Julianne Scott Pollock, just before we went to break, you were explaining that in your research with disabled professionals, you found that one of the emergent themes was the notion they felt they needed to embody a character. Tell us about those characters that pop up.
Sure. It's this idea that because disability just makes us so uncomfortable, especially in the professional space. Because you think about in the professional space, all these rules about like your hair's not supposed to be too big in a professional space. Your makeup shouldn't be too dark. Your perfume or cologne shouldn't be too strong. You shouldn't be showing too much skin. So there's all these things we do to control the professional body and to make it so that we don't really think about the body when we're doing professionalism. And then here's this body that comes in that's demanding our gaze, that's very different, that is a disabled body. And they say, so a lot of times how that happened was this idea of there's this character feeling of how to perform. Now, I named these characters based on these descriptions that came over and over again throughout these 26 interviews. And there was the superhero. The person's like, really, disability is something that is completely overcome. This employee is better than the rest of us. Really, it's an inspiration, larger than life, better than abled person. And so there was that idea. It's like you can't just be an employee, you have to be the best one that's there. And then there's this idea of the long-suffering warrior hero who, oh my goodness, look at that person not complaining, clearly in pain, but always here and doing their job or sick. But this is idea, this person is really showing us what it means to press through. But once someone can't be the warrior hero anymore, there's this idea of, like, you need to turn into the tragic hero, which is as valiant and wonderful it was to have you get out because you're making things difficult, right? It's this idea of this, like, it gets that point. And if when that happens, you won't. There's a bit of a villain that comes out of this person who is using resources. They can't do the job, but they're still here. They shouldn't be. We can't get rid of them. And it becomes a sort of adversary in the workplace. So these, across the interviews, I could place each interview into one of these spaces. And some people moved through them, started out as a warrior, and then things went downhill. You know, so those are kinds of that ideas of how that happened.
As you look at these characters, is what do you do with that information? Is that something that we need to change culturally? Do we need to look at how we set up our professional workspaces? I mean, how does that change?
Well, the idea is to really bring attention to it so we can start talking about what is making us so uncomfortable about a disabled body.
Because you're saying then that these characters emerge from able-bodied people's discomfort with their perceptions of that disabled person.
Of that disabled person. And it's difficult because unlike other markers of difference, other identity markers of difference, such as gender, such as race, when we look at disability, it's the absence of normalness. Ability is normal. Disability means we're only defining you as different because there's the absence of being normal. And so here's this idea. And so they're like, okay, so what are we going to do with this? And that creates anxiety because at some level, and I make this argument, and there might be people who disagree, I think we all know disability because we all know we're mortal. We all know that we're living in bodies that will break down, that are going to change. We know for sure that's going to happen. And it's not that we know that it might happen. It really is going to. None of us are immortal. And so there is this fear. And if we can think about, wait, we're doing this because we, instead of being with this fear and changing society to accommodate our changing bodies, changing workspaces to accommodate the fact that bodies are going to change, we instead are trying to pretend that's not going to happen and push it out of our minds. So if we really embrace the fact that we're all living in mortal bodies that need to be cared for and need a culture and a space that will flex around and be willing to adapt as we need adaption. Because if we had that knowledge, if we could know that, we could be with disability without that anxiety.
And that's where the notion of an ability spectrum comes
yes.
into play for you. You've yeah. said that the spectrum ranges from death to Olympic athletes.
Right.
And so all of us will encounter disability at some point in our lives in one way or another.
Yes. I mean, unless there's a very sudden going from very able to disappearing from this earth, we're all going to move across that spectrum. And we're going to be injured or sick and we're going to move. Like, we move on this spectrum constantly. The idea that there's this binary that either you're disabled really is an artificial sort of thing we've created in order to marginalize some of these bodies disabled while the rest of us are all okay, when in reality we're all moving.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking today about how we define disability and how we perceive it in our culture. With us, Julianne Scott Pollack, Associate Professor in the Communication Studies Department at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. She researches existing stigmas around disability in our culture and embodiment and identity. You can ask your own question of Julianne Scott Pollack on this Wednesday by calling us at 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org. We had a listener write in. She says, I think it's important to note that not all disabilities are visible. Some of us have physical or emotional different abilities that wax and wane. We are all temporarily able-bodied. What would you say to her?
Well, that idea of invisible disabilities, that idea that there aren't always those markers that are there to let people know the disability is there. And I think in a lot of situations, the villains in the research had that sort of situation. Like, you look healthy. We think you're gaming us. We think there's really not an issue here. Would be something that someone – so there is this idea of understanding that you might not have the power – to categorize someone. And that's not your power to have. We have no idea what it's like to be in another body. We only know our own. And so that idea of, again, that culture that flexes and moves and understands that people are going to need a need changing spaces and changing abilities. And that's because emotionally, we change. Physically, we change. Sometimes when someone is experiencing pain, that pain comes and goes. And there's different ways that this happens to all of our bodies. And allowing that space of, it's okay to need emotional space. It's okay to need emotional healing. It's okay that just because you can't see why that person is being accommodated doesn't mean that accommodation isn't just. And if you need accommodation, we want a space that you can get those accommodations too. And so that's a lot of, I think, that understanding of, and because when we use the word, and I hate the word accommodations in so many ways, because it sounds like other people are, you know, being benevolent to you, when in reality, we all need changing, adaptable spaces, no matter what place and time our body or might be now.
So how do we use language around this? You've referred to yourself. You explained a few minutes ago why you choose to call yourself a disabled person, mm-hmm. not a person with a disability.
Correct.
And you respect other people's choice to do the first and first language. If there's a spectrum, and if we're all somewhere on that spectrum, and where we are on the spectrum changes throughout the course of our lives, how do we use language? What is a disabled body and what is a normal body?
Well, the idea is, like, I think normal is really a creation, right? It's this really social creation of what normal is. Normal changes with the culture, with the time, with the context. It's really this idea of normal is who gets to be in the center. Right. It's this idea who gets to be in the center of culture and who's going to be pushed to that periphery that's going to get these accommodations that we're going to benevolently give them. So the term normal is so problematic in so many ways. And that idea, instead of talking about we all have different abilities. We have to look at that idea of ability instead of saying disabled, saying what are your ability needs?
Does normal differ from culture to culture?
Oh, very much so. If we lived in some portions of Africa, if you can't walk the 5 miles a day to the river with being able, and then carry the water back, you are a disabled, hindering person within that space, right? So there's different, depending on where you are, what your ability needs are different. There's some places that you need to be able to drive a car to function. There's other places that cars are really optional and not driving is not a disability, right? So there's all these different, there's some jobs that needing flex time isn't really in any way causing any sort of ability disruptions to the office. Some jobs it is. So it really changes depending on space. And in so many ways, we define the disabled person as the person who is disrupting how we'd like to do things. Right? How are they disabled? They're disabled because they can't do what the rest of us are expecting them to do right now. And that's how suddenly we move from abled to disabled.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking today about how we view disability in our culture. With us, Julianne Scott Pollock, Associate Professor in the Communication Studies Department at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. You can ask your own question of our expert on this Wednesday by calling us at 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. Julianne Scott Pollock, can you sort of take us through what it's like for a person who is in, say, a wheelchair, mm-hmm. to go into a space that is compliant with the Americans with Disabilities Act, mm-hmm. ADA compliant, considered accessible, and let's pick a public space like a theater, mm-hmm. and there's this one spot in the corner down front where that person can go and sit, but it's compliant and accessible. Can you talk about what it's like for that person to go into that space? Do they feel accommodated? Do they feel stigmatized?
Well, and it's hard because it would depend on who that person was and how they're feeling about that space. And some, I can say I spent a very short stint in a wheelchair during my bone rotation. So I had a little bit of time and I could talk how I always thought how fascinating it was. I'm like, wow. Like getting in through the disabled door is taking the scenic route. I gotta go all the way around here to get up this ramp and then in. And then there's one seat it's right there. If other people are by, like, so it becomes, for me, it was a lot of labor, right? This labor to go out was so much that I'd have to think, am I in this space to do this or am I not? But my time in that wheelchair was temporary, which meant I could say, well, but if that's your life all the time, if you use that wheelchair, if that wheelchair is your vehicle to access, that's something that you're having to navigate. And that idea, like, how wonderful would it be if all the seats in the theater were movable and that person could sit anywhere? Or if we just had ramps going in so that you didn't need this scenic route in order to use the ramp and accommodate the stairs, but if you just could use any space and come right through the door, right? Because really, ramps aren't hindering anyone.
So you're putting forth the notion of a design concept that it does away with stairs entirely.
Yeah, it's this idea, like, why can't we just have a really accommodating space that as our bodies change, we're able to still use that space the same way? And that ramp being right in the front would be wonderful for me when I'm holding my 3-year-old in one arm and my 9-month-old in the other with my 5-year-old holding on to me. It would be easier for me to get into the movie theater as well, even though I don't need a wheelchair.
Are some states better than others for people who have disabilities? You had an experience moving to North Carolina from Maine. Can you tell us about that?
Well, and in a lot of ways, I would say some states are more diligent with ADA compliance, perhaps, than others for a host of different reasons. Money that's there, where old buildings are, is there a way to renovate those buildings, how much new infrastructure is going up. So it's a lot of ways, like, it can even vary from regions of state. Some regions of the state are much more open to a universal design. That universal design is that space that is flexible and accommodates all different kinds of abilities. So it can really change because it's expensive. Changing the physical space, making something ADA compliant is expensive. And it may, in a lot of ways, means the aesthetics you might want of that building are going to need to change in order for this to happen. And that's a tug, a push and pull.
Especially here in Wilmington. So much of downtown Wilmington's identity is based on the fact that it's a historic place. So what would you say to people? You know, we have so many jewels in the crown of Wilmington just downtown that are beautiful historic buildings. What would you say to people who argue, you can't touch this building? This is reminiscent of an era. This is an important part of our history.
Well, and I think that's a complex question. I mean, as a person who studies aesthetics, and by aesthetics, I mean not only things that are beautiful. I mean that idea of things that pull meaning and emotion to us, because when we see that space, it's meaningful to us. But that idea of to assume that that space cannot be meaningful and also open to different embodiments is a dangerous road to go down. There are people that during the civil rights movement said, but our all white spaces are meaningful to us. We don't want integration. There are people that during women's rights vote, they're like, voting is a really masculine space and you're bringing women into it. It's changing it. It's like, yep, it did. And thank goodness we have those changes now. And so that idea of, like, can we still preserve that space and make it accommodating? Well, I think we can. We have some brilliant universal designers who can help make that happen. But it needs to be a financial priority that isn't just put on people who are trying to run that business. That is important enough to the state, to the community, to make those changes for all different kinds of bodies so that we can all be in those spaces together and to know so that you, not you in particular, but this person who loves a space, to know that as your body changes through life, you can still be here too.
You had a driver's license when you lived in Maine.
I did.
And then you moved to North Carolina.
I did.
And you went to get your North Carolina license.
I did.
How did that work out?
That was a journey. I had no idea when I came to North Carolina. I have been driving for a very long time, since I was 16 years old. I've never gotten a ticket. I've never been in an accident, so I consider myself a fairly good driver. And so when they told, so when I came to get my new license, I told, oh, you just have to take, they said, a written test, and then you get your new license. I said, okay, awesome. So I took the written test. I did great. And I was all ready to get my license. They said, oh, can I also get my disability placard? And they said, no. And looked closer. And they said, and looked closer at my license before. And they said, can we need to talk for a minute? I'm like, to me? And they're like, no. And so they went and talked and came back. And they said, you need a road test. I said, I do? You already took my picture for my license. They said, yeah, well, with disabilities, you need a road, a disabled driver needs a road test, or a driver with, they might have said driver with a disability. I said, really? Because you already gave me my license. They said, we don't have to give you a license to anybody. He goes, it's a privilege, not a right. And you need to take a road test if you want. And we can demand anybody have a road test anytime. So I took the road test. My 3-point tour was a little rusty, but pretty good. And so so I passed it. And so then they, and so I passed it. And then I got a call a month later from I got a letter telling me I had to go to like this special facility at Duke that was going to assess my driving ability with a driver for CP, and it was like going to be hundreds of dollars to go get this assessment because I had cerebral palsy, I had said, but wasn't asking for adaptive equipment in my car. And they were very worried that perhaps, like, well, I don't need adaptive equipment. So I called them, and calling Raleigh, I was on the phone forever. With different people, not forever because I'm not on there now, but I was on there for quite a long time. And it took a long time. I finally got through, and it was all these different operators saying, like, well, listen, we don't know if your feet can move to hit reach the pedal. I'm like, well, I've been driving since I was 16. You can look up. I have a license. Of course I've been driving. And they're like, well, we can't know that for sure. So finally, after pushing and then calling a friend who's a lawyer who then also called, they moved the assessment to my local doctor so it would be free because I have with my copay. So I went, and I said, I need a physical anyway. Fine, fill out the form. So I filled out the form, I sent it to them, and they sent it back saying they wanted me to go back and do another road test there. So I went back and did another road test there, and then I got another letter, and at that point I started getting lawyers involved, and it suddenly went away.
You're listening to Coastline. Today we're exploring the world through the eyes of a person with a disability, and we're challenging traditional notions of what disability even means. Julianne Scott-Pollock, a researcher at UNCW and an associate professor in the Communication Studies Department, is with us today and answering your questions. When we come back from this 90-second break, you'll have one more segment to ask your question on this Wednesday. You can do that by sending an email to coastline@whqr.org or by calling us at 910-343-1138. You're listening to Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Today, we're learning about what it's like to live with a disability in our culture and our cultural perceptions around that. Our guest today is Julianne Scott-Pollock, an associate professor of communication studies at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington, where she researches personal narratives of embodiment and identity, looking at physical disability, eating disorders, and aging and memory. You have a few minutes left to ask your question on this Wednesday, and you can do that by calling us at 910-343-1138 or emailing us at coastline@whqr.org. Julianne, I want to get a little bit into how people who don't have an obvious disability, physical disability, or haven't known anyone who has lived with that, people who are well-intentioned but perhaps quite ignorant, some of the things they run up against. For instance, if someone has a physical disability, let's say they're in a wheelchair, is it common for other people to assume that person also has a mental disability? Or maybe they're partially deaf?
Well, we'd love to say that's not true, but it is. I mean, I think a lot of times people hear that I have cerebral palsy, and they're very surprised I'm a professor. Because cerebral palsy is sometimes because it happens through traumatic brain injury at birth, they assume that traumatic brain injury can also cause a cognitive challenges as well. So it's this idea of oh, well, I knew a person, though, and they had both of those. It's like, yes, but those were two disabilities together. So can someone who is using a wheelchair also have an intellectual disability? Of course. Should that ever be assumed? No, never to assume that sort of question. So it's really about how we do collapse them together based on that one person we saw or that one person we heard about. I know that a lot of times doctors will say, I remember one of my OBGYN doctors on having my son said, you know, I just can't wait to tell my patients who have children that have cerebral palsy all that you've accomplished and how great everything happened. Because they're clinging to this idea of that one story they heard. And so this idea of, like, to know that human bodies are so unique and how that body is experiencing illness, disability, emotions, thought is just so unique, is to give that body space to teach you. And that doesn't mean you asking questions and needing being tutored right there. But that idea of observe and see what that person is needing. And really, if we interact with people, we're such social creatures. Humans can understand and process and adapt to one another. We really can. So instead of coming with all these preconceived notions, interact in that space and get to know with time what that person is needing. And knowing that if people need help, they'll ask. And so, and if they don't, and you want to say, do you need assistance? If they say no, then, you know, to give that person space, to really allow people the agencies to be in charge of their own experience when sharing spaces with you.
And so does that mean don't ask questions first, just step back, and as you say, give that person space? What are some of the other, don't do this. People do this all the time to a person with a disability, and the community of people with disabilities would like to say, please don't ever do this again. What are some of those things?
Some of those things, I'm trying to think of I go together with a society of disability scholars, and we think of things that, and some things that people told me that have different embodiments than I have, and that idea of don't assume that you can touch somebody's wheelchair. The wheelchair in so many ways has become an extension of that person's body, and they probably don't want you to touch it unless they're inviting you into that space. So if they say, please push me, well, then that's great. Don't assume that they want to be pushed. That idea of
don't. And why is that important? Let's hang with that distinction for a second, because, you know, in looking at this, there are blogs all over the place about I'm in a wheelchair. This is my life at crotch level. This is what I have to deal with. And this is what I want you guys to understand. And that's one of the biggest ones. Why is it so offensive for a person to come over and grab the wheelchair and start pushing it?
Well, I think the same way it would be offensive if somebody suddenly started grabbing your arm and forcing you to go in a direction you don't want to go. That wheelchair is really, because that wheelchair is allowing the person, the facilitating that moving through space, it's become an extension of the body. And in that way, because it's an extension of the body, treat it with the same respect you would treat that person's body. And that usually means not touching it. Unless you're very close to that person and you know that you've been invited in that space and that's okay to do.
If we start incorporating the idea of a spectrum more fully into our thinking and talking and dealing with bodies and different levels of ability, accepting that everyone has various levels of ability through their lives, what would that change in our culture? Why is that distinction important?
What it would do is really see embodiment as part of being human, instead of something that we need to be frightened of and manage to avoid becoming one of those disabled people. And so that it's that idea of, listen, all of our bodies are going to change and have different needs. And that idea means that we start looking at society as something we need to create to facilitate how our bodies are going to change, right? So universal design makes all of us move through space better. This idea of the idea that people might have emotional needs, well, we all have emotional needs. And those emotional needs are changing all the time. So having that ability to be comfortable talking about all of us, what our emotional needs are at a specific time. So in a lot of ways, it makes it so we're able to talk about who am I now in this space? Who are you now in this space? and what do we need to be in this space and live vibrantly together instead of sectioning us off as the disabled person who's going to need all these accommodations and me who's so normal that is going to have to mentally accommodate them.
And would that also dissolve some of the shame around aging bodies, around bodies with different levels of ability? I mean, is shame part of this conversation?
Oh, shame is central to this conversation. That idea, the stigma going on, if we want to look at stigma, and that idea of being sad for disabled people is on in a lot of ways. Like when people would look at my body and feel sad, they were empathizing with shame that for I didn't have and that I tended to overcome quickly because I was always in dialogue with people about my body and what it meant to be disabled. I was also fairly well-spoken from a young age and could have these dialogues and conversations to resist that idea. But that is where that shame is, and that idea that something's wrong with me now, and because something's wrong with me, I have to be grateful that people are allowing me to be in this space. And how scary can that be, to be one of those people that now everyone's accommodating in this space? I think of there's this meme that goes around Facebook all the time that says, I secretly want to punch slow-walking people in the back of their heads. And I always think to myself, like, and I think they're saying, like, you're taking up too much.
Right.
And I'm not sure exactly what, but I think to myself, really? So when I'm walking slow because I'm a little bit in pain today, or when I'm carrying my three kids, you're kind of wanting to punch us? I'm like, that's sobering. That's frightening. That's shaming to bodies that move slower and take up more space. And for us to get to that point of like, no, because everybody's body is taking up space and everybody's body is moving and everybody's body needs to be able to move in this area. So instead of making this hierarchy of abled versus disabled, to really see us all moving together and moving in different ways with different kinds of means, whether those be disabilities we can see or disabilities that we can't see. But if we're mindful of the emotional and the physical and the intellectual that is being human, and that all those are different, we can start combating that shame.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking with Julianne Scott Pollack, an associate professor in the Communication Studies Department at UNCW. She looks at existing stigmas around disability in our culture and personal narratives, embodiment, and identity. You can ask your own question of Julianne Scott Pollack on this Wednesday by emailing us at coastline@whqr.org or giving us a call at 910-343-1138. Is having a disability different for a white person compared to a person of color? Or is it different for a man compared to a woman?
You know, disability is one identity marker. And how that identity marker moves in our lived experience is going to be so person specific. And that we argue a lot within disability studies, is there a disability culture or not? And I would say, there are some disabled people that I come together with, and we sort of have this culture of what it means to move through space like we do. And so there might be this shared experience, but I don't even know if I'd call it a culture, though, because I think of my culture. I think of my culture of being Italian-American. I think the culture of being an academic. There's a different kind of idea of like of coming around where, because disability embodiment is so specific, and disabilities are so specific to an embodiment, they tend to not as much have a culture as far as a personal lived experience. Though I will of course say that dealing with able bias does bind people with disabilities with a shared understanding, even if we don't have traditions that I would put as part of a culture like I would for my ethnic identity, or like when I move into female space, women's space. So there's different kinds of ways in that way that I would say. But we're such complex creatures that if you're dealing with racial stigma on a daily basis, if you're dealing with gender stigma in a space, that might become at the forefront. That might just become more important. Or those might interact in ways that are complex because disability might be in some ways pushing you to the periphery of the dominant of that culture. So that idea of like understanding that our identities are so complex, we call this intersectionality, that all of our identities are intersecting simultaneously. We can't really divide them out. And how those identities are going to come together and how we're going to live them is just going to be so person-specific. I think of the idea of how I'm a woman who likes to go to, likes to work out, likes to be active. And so there are some active cultures I'm a part of. But being disabled means I'm not invited into some of those spaces because I might not move as fast or I have more difficulty moving in sync. And so this idea of, well, this might be our space of women who are fit, because I'm disabled, I'm not part of that space.
So when you take a look at a sector of the population that is marginalized in other ways, you mentioned racial stigma or gender bias. What about someone who falls into one of those categories, is dealing with that, and also has an obvious physical disability? How do they have a harder time?
Oh, well, we would say yes, compounded disability, systems of privilege, right? This idea, if you have racial privilege, that means that's one less thing you're dealing with, that someone with a disability, someone who does, if you, do, oh, let me, I'm going to start over. The idea of like, if you have, if you're dealing with racial biases, it means that you're having to overcome things that people who have racial privilege do not. You're facing barriers, you're facing tensions, you're facing all of these discriminations that this other person isn't. That's why in a lot of ways I say, I use disabled first, but as a white educated person, I have that luxury that disability isn't so disruptive to my life that I don't feel I need that, that I could say this is my piece of activism here, where someone else saying, listen, I am dealing with so much stigma that I really want person first language. That's helping me. Or someone who is really dealing with racial discrimination might say, listen, I need to deal, my racial identity, my racial discrimination is at the forefront for me. And so I might not be at this point being as much of an activist in this area, even though it matters to me as well. So it's this idea of like the more levels of discrimination, the more marginalized, the less privilege you have, the more difficult your situation is. A lot of times with a disability, socioeconomic privilege. If you're disabled but you have enough money to accommodate that disability, your experience is going to be so different than someone who is just fighting for the bare necessities financially to get by. So I would say when you pile on all these different kinds of ways we marginalize people, call them not center, call them not normal, the more of those things you're dealing with, the harder and the more challenging day-to-day interactions are going to be.
We have an email. Sandy writes, I appreciate this conversation. Glad to hear your guest acknowledge the complexities of ADA compliance. That's the Americans with Disabilities Act. It can be complicated to navigate affordability, aesthetics. Wondering if she could comment on the possibility of a significant backfire effect given the forced compliance of public buildings. In my observation, there are sometimes burdens placed on those who have to design and build or renovate that are truly over the top and probably unnecessary. This results in the public resenting the people these laws were designed to enable. This is very sad. Do you see lawmakers ever reconsidering or easing up on some of the more extensive requirements that frankly are simply unaffordable and redundant for many entities, public and private?
Well, and I would have to know like where those redundancies are. I can't say for sure. I don't know exactly what pieces of the law might feel overwhelming. But I do know that's there. I know that idea of the expense can be overwhelming. And I think that's what we need to really be thinking of is lawmakers, if this is so important, and it is, it's so important that our bodies are able to move through space, that as they change, they can. Is there ways to be able to help these businesses? Because we're going to make it a priority. We're going to make it a priority. So let's, as a society, put both our efforts and our resources towards making this happen instead of having it all fall on, say, the one person doing those renovations. Is there a way to have support of the culture, say, this is important enough that there's going to be some help to make this happen?
And that's this edition of Coastline. Julianne Scott Pollack, such a pleasure having you with us today. Coastline's executive producer is Cleve Callison. Producer is Isabel Shepherd. Technical director is Ken Campbell. Join us for Thursday's Coastline when we explore the reintegration of South Carolina loyalists after the Revolutionary War with author and historian Rebecca Brannan. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at whqr.org or get the podcast from the iTunes store. Tune in for the rebroadcast of this episode on Sunday afternoon at 3. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. Thank you.